All right. I want to introduce next Derek Schindel, who's from the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at Rutgers, and he's going to have a step back for a moment and just give us an overview of some of the potential issues related to air and environmental quality and child care.
Thank you. Thanks, Jen. So I just actually reviewed my slides quick. I purposely did not put anything about pesticides or IPM because I knew you were talking, but let's assume that she came about 40 minutes later and that was one of the issues I was going to just at least mention. Okay, so I'm here from Rutgers, and I've worked with Shonda in the past on asthma in Georgia regarding school-age children. So Shonda asked me as part of this session to sort of translate for the K-12 environment where the kids are either pre-K all the way up to even age 21 if they're students with special health needs, and sort of address what the range of indoor air and environmental quality issues could be in child care environments. Sometimes, they're, as you all know, they could be in homes, they could be affiliated with school districts or schools, or they could be separate buildings unto themselves. I'm also going to try to tie in a little bit of anecdotal experience from a project we did with four students in the US EPA Region 2, which predominantly focused on pesticides and IPM, but was also a way for the students to see what else was going on. So I have no conflict of interest to disclose. One thing about daycare centers and schools, when I go over this with undergrad and graduate students, we talk about indoor microenvironments. You can't really say they're occupational or they're non-occupational because they're both. They're sort of these special cases, much like other specific microenvironments, because they're occupational settings for all of us or anyone that works part-time or full-time in child care centers. So that means that various agencies may or may not be able to have jurisdiction at local, state, and federal levels. And I've listed a whole host of different kinds of professionals, depending on where these child care centers are located, that could be considered staff, and therefore it's their work environment. Now, clearly, the little children are the most susceptible and vulnerable subgroup, but there are other susceptible groups that could be present working. So in terms of exposure agent categories, I mean, the general concept is that there's five major categories: biological, chemical, physical, including ergonomics, radiological, where the main one may be to think about would be radon, and social stressors. We tend to think in the exposure sciences nowadays that social stressors, they could be their own category, or it's a co-exposure between some sort of social stress or some marker of stress like cortisol with one of these other agent categories. The key thing is, besides these being the main five, usually things occur in mixtures. Chemical pesticides themselves are mixtures of chemicals that are active and inactive ingredients. I also mentioned a couple of things about indoor microenvironments just because I am a scientist engineer, but just to briefly introduce the idea that outdoor air influences indoor air, and these pollutants can be in different phases, whether they're solid, being particles in the air like dust, or maybe in the gas phase, or even sometimes gases attach to particles. They come in, they react. So there's all kinds of other things that go on, which is why we try to minimize or prevent exposure by addressing the sources of these agents, for example, chemicals and different products. The other thing we want to keep in mind for all these different potential exposure agents is how our own activity patterns or behaviors affect indoor air and environmental quality. So, for example, even if we're doing proper operations and maintenance activities, like cleaning, which could be every day, it could be multiple times a day, it may be for certain things at daycares and schools, maybe every other day or once a week, but just the type of mopping or sweeping that's done can make a difference for certain types of pollutants like particulate matter. How you dust surfaces, do you use varnishes, what kinds of cleaning products do you use? Are they concentrates, were they bought in containers and you're just using it as it was purchased? Speaking of things that you can buy and bring indoors, in my own school-based research experience, this turned out to be a major source of these volatile organic compounds, people's personal care products. What people bring in to teach, because unfortunately, as we all know, resources are dwindling at public charter and private schools. So teachers who are trying to do the best job they can will supplement what they get from the districts or their schools by bringing in arts and crafts supplies or other things they want to use for their teaching. Some of those things may not be water-based. They may actually contain certain chemicals. Air fresheners are a source of VOCs. And then it's very uncommon, but if there were, say, candles or incense in a home that was also being used for daycare, those things, when they're lit, emit not just scents, which are VOCs, but also particulate matter in the smaller size fractions. finished materials emit chemical compounds, and depending on the type of material, could be a source of food if they got wet, say from moisture damage from a flood or a leak or maybe rain coming in through a window if you're not careful, and mold could develop. And then, of course, only because if there were childcare centers with cooking areas, whether they were of any of the types, private or related to school districts, if there's cooking and heating sources, that means that certain other pollutants, some of which are known environmental asthma triggers, could also be emitted into the indoor space. So there are various acute and chronic health concerns, and what Sean and I wanted to just sort of summarize are some of the main ones, but this is not supposed to be an exhaustive list by any means. But, you know, some of the key ones of main concern for acute or very short-term exposures would be the irritation of our various membranes. So, for example, you have a contact dermatitis, which could be on your hand or a forearm or an elbow. You could have eczema, which could be a recurring rash, which may or may not also be related to someone having asthma, and that could be on various parts of the body. Then you also have asthma, flu, and other types of respiratory illnesses. I underlined the classic symptoms of asthma, which, as you can see, are sometimes also symptoms of other respiratory illnesses or even just allergies that people may have due to indoor-outdoor triggers, even something complex like sick building syndrome. Sick building syndrome, by the way, is not the same as a building-related illness, which would be more like a Legionnaire's disease or something that was particular, but it has been reported among office workers, and it's starting to be reported in initial studies out of Europe for even school occupants, where you have teachers and students being assessed in older buildings that are very tight and therefore dependent on mechanical ventilation. Some of the other chronic concerns I've listed here, you can sort of see for yourself, but they cover things that are related, again, to biological, chemical, or physical exposures. So repetitive stress disorders may not be something you might think about in childcare, but when I was thinking about how would you explain why this might be relevant, well, if you're lifting things constantly and those things are boxes, or maybe children are varying weights, and you're in smaller spaces where if you're not bending properly or you're twisting and turning, because obviously we all know these little kids are moving around fast or crawling around fast, that could be for some relatively older employees or people that have been doing this for a long time a source of potential respiratory stress in certain parts of the body. Some of these other things may or may not be directly related to working in childcare, but they could potentially develop over time if there was continuous exposure to some of the things in these products. And we're learning more about these chemicals in these products. I think NSAID and some others are going to mention that later too. So for biological agents, for me what it boils down to is if you can prevent these two key things, a source of moisture and a source of food being these cellulose-based materials found in the types of things I've listed, you should be able to prevent excess mold or fungi. There's always going to be some that comes from the outdoors to the inside, it's whether you're in an agricultural area or just in an urban or suburban setting. But, you know, you can identify and prevent leaks from various sources. You can certainly clean up quickly spills of these various things, which may or may not even have sugar in them and, you know, lead to some other kinds of issues. And then also the idea of thermal comfort parameters like heat and temperature do make a difference in terms of how fast a mold could grow indoors. Chemical exposure, I've listed several different ones up here. Again, I purposely did not list pesticides, which are chemical mixtures. I knew another talk was going to cover that. One of the main sources of carbon dioxide indoors is each of us. And so the interesting thing about childcare centers for me when we did that EPA project is I asked the students, even if it was totally separate from what EPA Region 2 wanted, I said, take note of what the directors are saying their typical and maximum occupancies are. And we sort of considered that in relation to, say, class size reduction initiatives that some states have or the fire code-based occupancy that's supposed to be the maximum capacity for adults or children, and you'd be surprised. It seems like sometimes those occupancies get exceeded when maybe special events are occurring or everyone's there and it's raining and they have to stay indoors. So that could lead to elevated levels of CO2 as well as higher levels of particulate matter if people are all moving around indoors, whether or not there's any tracking in from the outside. Speaking of this one question I posed at the bottom, carpets can be sinks for pollutants, and then as activity occurs, crawling, walking, running around, things get resuspended. But one of these new emerging issues, if it's an older home or let's say someone has had a home and they're converting part of it to a daycare, would be either this idea of second or third-hand smoke, third-hand smoke being second-hand smoke that can resuspend over time from these kinds of services. But also, I don't know how familiar some of you are in your areas, hopefully you're not, but there's been homes where, when I was working in Atlanta, that were former meth labs, and people bought these homes or were renting homes, and they had to basically vacate, and in some cases, major renovation had to be done because of the residue of the methamphetamine that had been made. Now, I'm not an expert in that area, but I heard a talk this summer where they're detecting levels on various surfaces, even, you know, well after the time that it had been done. So that's just something to keep in mind, that carpets are important for safety and they reduce noise, but you want to maintain them well and sort of know what's going on if it's an older home converted to a daycare. VOCs, the rest of these slides I've actually set up to sort of talk about just how you would prevent either the emissions and therefore the exposure and the health risk, or how you would mitigate, because sometimes these things are going to exist. It's just not possible to completely eliminate at the top of the industrial hygiene hierarchy. We want to take those other levels of controls in the middle. So, for example, there's various sources, I already mentioned them before, but to mitigate, you can use adequate ventilation with proper filtration. And if those systems are maintained, you will dilute and hopefully also exhaust the outside those VOC concentrations. And also, for teachers and other staff that are doing cleaning or use of personal care products, or even certain types of teaching products where they be maybe preparing a small lesson or a game for the kids, when they do it, maybe it's better to do that during unoccupied times or when they're outside for some sort of play time where they're taking a nap in another room, not when everyone's there, because that's when the exposure could be highest. Some of the emerging issues that Sean and I thought we would at least talk about, especially when you have some older buildings, the idea of polychlorinated biphenyls. So those can exist mainly in two different sources, we'll say. I was going to say categories, we'll say two sources. Older lighting fixtures with electronic ballast, the ones that, you know, those fluorescent lightings, sometimes they found in schools, and it was first shown in the Boston area, where if they start leaking because they're old and degrading, then PCBs will come out. Of course, those bulbs, if they break or start leaking, also have other things potentially like mercury. Then there's the caulking around older windows and window frames, and even doors if you have a door from the inside to the outside. A colleague of mine, again from the Boston area, sort of found pretty high levels of PCBs just in caulking. So the problem is that that caulking starts degrading and becomes part of the dust, say on the windowsills or on the floors. You know, if this is the window and the floor is right here, dust gets resuspended, or kids are crawling around and it gets onto their hands and non-dietary ingestion into their mouths. So the idea being, in older schools or older daycare, you want to retrofit and sort of just assume that this has been found, and disposal has to be done properly if you are going to retrofit windows or these lightings. And a lot of times it will be considered hazardous waste. The bisphenol A and the phthalate. So I use these acronyms, and I'm not going to go through and define each one. These are various types of phthalates that have gotten attention in the research. Some of them have also been found in a lot of these plastic flexible products, even in healthcare settings. But the sippy cups, various toys, pacifiers, we detected it in dust in homes of older adults with asthma, where they have the tubes connected to the oxygen tanks if they had asthma and COPD. So there's various types of products which have a role in both healthcare and daycare, but there also are alternatives. So these concerns, of course, are because they've been shown in toxicology and initial epidemiology to be hormone or endocrine disruptors and even carcinogens. So one idea for prevention is buy alternative products. Our section, when we gave out water bottles for our 100th anniversary, they were stainless steel. That was one of the reasons. One note about these evolving alternatives, that the NHANES, or National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data, are suggesting that these still can be detected in people's bodily fluids. And then there's even the BPS, which I didn't put up here. But these are two emerging alternatives where there's just science starting now. So another way to mitigate is to try to assume that if children have these certain behaviors where they're going to mouth or touch things and then touch other surfaces and then put it in their mouths, if we try to minimize that with certain products, or at least try to keep those products clean, and if they're old, maybe get replaced. If the degradation of the products is what may release some of these compounds over time from the plasticizers. Like I said, I've kept this to one slide. I think we can pass on it since we had such a good talk from the California area. So the only thing I would sort of add is the idea that, let's say even the least toxic pesticides were used for some reason because you have a field outside. Since 9/11, at least in my experience in California, Georgia, and the New York, New Jersey area, parks for schools tend to be gated or limited in time, but they're still shared with the community, especially after school and on weekends. So the idea of risk communication, when things are used, there's supposed to be proper notification. At least local and state laws are pushing for that, where if it's used maybe 24 to 48 hours before and after, people should stay away or at least be aware of what the risks are, because those things have just been applied regardless of the method of treatments that our colleague went over. So various physical exposures, asbestos fibers might be within the ceiling, either as structural insulation on the beams or in those cottage cheese type ceilings or even ceiling tiles if they're really old. As long as they're bound, there's no potential respiratory health risk. It's when people start doing renovations that are not done properly, or you want to hang mobiles or sort of other things from the ceiling and you're not aware of what might be happening. So I think if you've ever run in an apartment, you get some warnings from the EPA about lead and asbestos. So you want to keep that in mind if these buildings are old as well. Some of these other things I'm going to mention in a second. So in order to prevent or mitigate, you don't want to disturb the asbestos, and you do want to remove it if you think it's there by professionals who do it correctly according to EPA and other state guidelines, and then replace it with these fiberglass ceiling tiles that have good noise reduction coefficients and are not as expensive as those older ones were. So with lighting, one of the things is comparing fluorescent lighting with daylighting or skylighting. Some kids or even some adults may be more susceptible to the glare. I mean, how many of you have issues with glare? Like you might use screen on your or screens over your computer screens, or you wear your glasses, or you orient your workstations in a certain way. There's a reason for that. Either you're sensitive, or some people have been shown to have this Erlen or Scopic sensitivity syndrome. And this is something my colleague Claire Barnett and I learned about when we were trying to inform New York State policy, where, you know, sometimes you have to really talk to schools and daycare about where you put the teacher or one computer, or where a bank of computers go, and also what kind of lighting you put in, because there are guidelines for the amount of light, but it's also maybe the type of light and how close it is to incoming sunlight. I mean, there's an important role for sunlight, but for some kids or adults, it might be too much. So in addition to that, again, older fixtures could have PCBs, so you make sure they're get rid of properly, and bulbs, ideally the ones that are mercury-free, you definitely can look for those kinds of labels now on the market, even if you're replacing these yourself at a private childcare, Home Depot, Lowe's, they all either will take the old ones back and help recycle them properly, or they'll tell you these do not have certain things in them. Oh, maybe that's well in that. Noise. Believe it or not, in our Berkeley lab and UCLA-based research, the number one source of indoor noise in schools with the little kids and the high school kids was ourselves, much like with the carbon dioxide concentrations. Noise can be A-weighted decibels, or can be frequency or that annoyance factor. The HVAC systems and lighting fixtures in our experiments were probably what the annoyance or frequency issues were, and there could be multiple octave bands at play. But when it came to A-weighted decibels, what we think about when we're concerned with noise-induced hearing loss, or we're comparing those indoor exposures with outdoor exposures with airplanes and rock concerts when people do have earplugs in, it's the A-weighted decibels. There are other sources present in daycare and schools, as you can see. A lot of them are basically electronics behind the HVAC. So for prevention and mitigation, you know, we don't want to yell at each other and we don't want to yell at the children to try to get their attention for various reasons, but it is also to sort of reduce noise levels and just proper maintenance of all these other systems, not leaving TVs and radios on at full blast when they're not being used or not putting them full blast anyway. The last one is the most important thing I can say about noise or even outdoor air quality as it impacts indoor air quality. This is one or maybe two pages of my 400-plus page dissertation and appendix, and it led to my colleagues trying to get involved with UCR or UC Riverside with a bus study. We found that the air quality inside schools, especially portables, was impacted by idling delivery trucks or buses that were parked adjacent to the classrooms, especially delivery trucks. In the Berkeley lab work, we found that it was a major source of noise when they were sort of doing the jackhammering or just pulling up these trucks and idling because of the noise of the engines. So please try to not let that happen outside your child care center. It really impacts the noise as well as the outdoor air quality, especially for criteria plumes. So some other concerns separate from the pesticide issues that you already heard about. How many of you have heard of this chromated copper arsenate, which is, I think if you're from the Florida or some of the southern states, it's actually a Prop 65 listed preservative in California for railroad ties and what they cite mobile offices and portable or modular classroom pieces on. But it's also used as the enclosure for play areas and especially sandboxes. So sometimes if that pressure treated wood is old or it starts degrading, this can leach out, especially after rain. So this is something you might want to be aware of. If it looks like the wood around the play area or the sandbox is old, there is the potential for either dermal exposure or, you know, that sort of soil sand being contaminated. And this was brought into the literature about 8 to 10 years ago at this point. For play sets, it might be the same kind of wood, but more likely there's plastics or metals. And those metals can get pretty hot. So it may not even be a matter that they're painted with anything that contains lead, or if they were old play sets, you want to make sure they're not starting to chip away, because that would be a source of lead for the kids if they start eating the chips. But more importantly, I'm just thinking of the possibility of burns, especially among little kids that want to touch everything. I know we have, you know, my nieces and nephews are very young because my wife and I are the oldest in our family, and you know, my sister-in-law made sure that it was one of those newer plastic swing sets or that engineered wood, because the metal, you know, in the summer in New Jersey, Maryland, can get very hot, much like in many other parts of the country like we are here. For materials that could be on the either the playgrounds or the mats that get put below the equipment on these jungle gyms, it may be from asphalt to being right on grass to these new rubberized mats. There was some research in my university when we were UMBNJ about the exposures due to the mats and the bioavailability. And what it comes down to is, you know, if these mats are made out of different materials, I can't tell you exactly for sure, you know, which one's better than the other. Some of them are made out of recycled tires. Some of them are made out of other recycled material. But the key is, they do have a value for safety, but depending on their aging and if they're, you know, intact, if there's a lot of dust on them or they're starting to come apart, then kids might eat those little pieces, which is not good. But those little pieces, it's possible, could contain either certain residues or certain metals attached to the particles. So you do want to just be aware, if it's an older mat starting to degrade, that might be something you want to either replace or see if you can get fixed and maintained. So that's everything that Shonda and I were hoping to share with you, trying to, again, cover daycare and schools at once, including those where there might be the same thing on one campus. But if there's any questions, or if not, maybe at the end after you hear the talks about specific programs that address one or, you know, probably several of these things all at once.